Welcome to Make Ready episode number 5. Thank you for listening in. I'm your host, Duncan Robertson. On this episode, I had the chance to speak with Brian Singer. Brian is the manager of the communication design team at Facebook. Prior to joining Facebook, Brian was creative director and founder of Altitude Associates, a San Francisco-based creative agency that helps consumer brands engage people through inspiration. Altitude has worked on programs with companies such as Apple, Adidas, Stanford Lively Arts, and Chronicle Books, among others. Brian's work has garnered recognition from Communication Arts, AIGA 365, Print, How, Graphis, Step, AR100, and he has worked in the permanent collection of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Brian is also the creator of the 1000 Journals Project, a global art experiment where journals were passed from hand to hand. These journals have traveled to 40 countries and through every state in the United States. They've come to rest in hostels, cafes, and law offices. They have been the subject of treasure hunts, brought to remote mountaintops, abandoned at airports, and stolen at gunpoint. And my butchering. Brian's 1000 journal projects have been covered in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Wall Street Journal, Entertainment Weekly, Better Homes and Gardens, and many others. It is the subject of a book published by Chronicle Books and a feature-length documentary. The project was exhibited in the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in 2009 and the Skirball Cultural Center, Los Angeles, in 2011. Brian is the former president of the San Francisco chapter of AIGA and has taught in both the CCA Extension and Academy of Art University programs. He also serves on the advisory board for the San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery. Our conversation takes place roughly 1 year after Brian joined the Facebook team. Here it is, Make Ready episode number 5 with Brian Singer. My name is Duncan Robertson, and I'm here with Brian Singer. It's a lovely Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, it is. Okay.
It is Friday, and it is the afternoon. I really just kind of want to start off with getting your story about how you got into design, how you became a designer.
Okay.
So how did you?
Oh, we're starting.
Yeah, we're rolling.
You would hit on. It's funny. The how did you become a designer? I think everyone has their really interesting story about how it happened. Mm-hmm. I literally went through the state college applications and looked through the list of majors that you could major in, and graphic design looked interesting to me. I mean, I'd always liked art in high school.
Yeah.
And I just assumed I was going to go to college. It wasn't like a question. It was like, yeah, you're going to college. I just didn't know what I was going to do. And I looked down that whole long list, and the two things that I thought might be interesting were science and graphic design. And I chose graphic design.
That's interesting. Those are two somewhat related and somewhat non-related fields.
Yeah. I mean, we could go back even further, because when I was in, I don't know, fourth grade maybe, our school was doing a school play. And our class had to, like, draw program covers for the play. Mm-hmm. And my program cover was selected, and on the cover of the trifold piece of paper that they used for a program for the play. And I liked that so much. I liked the fact that something I had drawn got so much attention.
Sure.
That also might have hooked me into design, or just the need for some sort of, like, recognition or something for my work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's probably the real reason I'm a graphic designer.
Yeah. So you went to college for design. Did you go to a specific design school, or did you do a design program UT in Austin has a design program, but they're not just a design school.
So here's the shitty thing. I didn't even know that those schools existed. My high school guidance counselor person didn't even let me know that there were any private schools that did design. So I literally looked at the major. I saw that Cal Poly San Luis Obispo had a applied art and design major, and San Jose State at the time had a graphic design major as well. Those are the only two state schools at the time.
Okay.
And I wasn't going to go to UC because you had to write an entry, you had to write an essay to get in, and I'm lazy. So that's kind of how I picked the school.
Yeah.
Had I known that there were, you know, Cranbrook existed, mm-hmm. or, you know, SVA or Art Center or any of these places, I might have tried to go to one of those, but I just didn't even, I wasn't even aware.
That's, yeah, very similar to my story. I didn't even know, I didn't really know what design was, mm-hmm. you know, so I didn't even know why a certain school would be a design school and that would separate them. I basically thought design was advertising,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so people told me I should go into advertising because I liked to draw things.
I thought design was art, and yeah. it's not. So,
sure.
I learned my lesson.
But you still make work that fares towards the art side a little bit.
I try to. I think that's really where my heart is.
Yeah. So coming out of school, everybody always has that kind of bump, you know, like where they or that bump in their life, you know, where it's like, okay, now how do I actually do this?
Mm-hmm.
So where did you go from school?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have two internships before I graduated. And they were probably the worst experience of my life and one of the better experiences of my life just with the people I got to work with. Mm-hmm. And that sort of got me along the path of corporate identity, annual reports, that type of work.
Okay.
But towards the tail end of my college education, the internet was just starting to happen.
Okay.
And I actually took a class on the web in spring of 1995. And pretty much one of the students taught it because he was a tech guy. And I was really interested in multimedia. I wanted to do like interactive CD-ROMs.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated at a time where like leveraging, you know, a bit of knowledge of the internet I was able to get a job in a multimedia department of a design firm.
Cool. So that kind of burgeoning technology grabbed your interest.
It did.
You knew you wanted to do that.
It was really exciting and new at the time. The problem was that as soon as I got a job, the interactive CD market was crumbling
okay.
because it was too expensive and the internet was happening.
Right.
So I ended up spending the next year or more building a lot of first generation websites for like Netscape 1.1 and Netscape 2, like really early versions of the browser. So it wasn't a whole lot you could do. It wasn't that creative.
Yeah.
But I was doing like hand coding and, you know, raw HTML, you know, back when you could actually still do that stuff, you know, pretty easily. Yeah.
Without hiring somebody highly specialized in it.
Yeah. So it's back when a graphic designer could actually do it.
Yeah. There are still lots that try.
No, and honestly, there are those that are really good at it.
There
it's just
are,
like, I couldn't keep up. I'm just not as technical as I would need to be.
It's a very, very, very special individual, I think, that can really do good design and good web coding at the same time. You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
There are plenty of people who can manage, you know, but for mm-hmm. somebody to really be good at both, it's very, very rare.
Yeah.
So then was, I know eventually you started your own studio with Altitude. Was that the first iteration of starting your own practice?
Sort of. So I hopped around quite a bit in my career. I worked for, you know, Jacob Sultan Design Group for a few years. I moved to San Francisco to work for a company called Phoenix Pop. They were trying to compete with Organic and Sapient and Razorfish and those big agencies back in like 2000.
Yeah.
So this company blossomed to about 100 people and then proceeded to like lay off half the company and slowly start going under.
Mm-hmm.
As a symptom of the dot-com crash, like sure. all of their clients were startup companies. So when the website that I was hired to help build didn't pay their bills, you know, they had to lay off a huge portion of the company. So I hopped around there. I freelanced after that quite a bit. I freelanced for a lot of different companies. Probably most notably would be Chen Design Associates. I freelanced at Pentagram for a little while, Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And then actually took full-time employment at Morla Design with Jennifer Morla.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a while working with her. And then after that, I started Altitude, which was about 9 years ago or so.
So you had pretty diverse experience.
Yeah, I liked working with a lot of different design firms because you learn something new from everyone.
Yeah.
Some people are super strong creative but can't run a business. Some people are super strong with business but the work is kind of boring.
Yeah.
Some people are fun. Some people are really difficult to work with. But you have to sort of go through all those different types of environments to understand what actually works best for me.
Sure. Yeah. So do you feel like you got a good education by kind of bouncing around to different places about how to run your own business?
I think I learned a lot. I don't know that I ever learned how to run my own business.
Okay.
I would say a pretty decent designer, not mm-hmm. the greatest by far. But as far as running a business, I can't claim to be the okay. be the most business-minded person. I can think strategically. I know how things should work, but that doesn't mean I can implement them from a, you know, managing the cash flow of a company bringing in X number of dollars a year. Probably not my forte.
So when you started Altitude, did you have a structure in place to help handle those sides of things?
Not really. I mean, I had a bookkeeper, yeah. But essentially it was sort of, Altitude started out as sort of glorified freelancer.
Okay.
And I spent a lot of time with Apple, actually. Mm-hmm. So that was the bulk of my work for the first couple of years. And then I would end up hiring folks as like full-time contractors to support. So it never blossomed to like a 10-person firm. It was okay. the biggest, probably myself, three other, you know, freelancers in the office itself, and then maybe two other freelancers outside okay. just to manage some of the big projects. Because the smaller design firms, it's really hard to keep a steady workflow,
mm-hmm.
and it usually huge peaks and huge valleys of work depending on, you know, the timing of things. So it was made a lot of sense for me to keep it small and scale with people I trusted who I would lean on for design support.
That's an interesting model that you're talking about that I don't know that I've actually heard many people talk about before. It may be common and I just haven't heard it before, but that idea of that the really technically the studio is you and you have a bookkeeper, and then when you need more people, you're contracting that in
mm-hmm.
and they may come work there with you. But it seems like in most cases that I'm more familiar with that people are hiring someone on, and then if work kind of dries up, they have to let them go. You know, but if you're contracting, there's a little more freedom there. That's kind of a nice model.
Yeah, well, it's I think less fair to the contractors, you know, who probably want full-time jobs.
Sure.
It's just hard when the work is so up and down to commit. I also realize that while running Altitude, you know, there were weekends and there were late nights, but for the most part, I went home at 6 o'clock every day. Yeah. I didn't want to work overtime. I didn't want my employees to work, not employees, my the contractors, to work much overtime either. There was a really nice sort of work-life balance.
Yeah.
And had I wanted to go out and sell harder and land more work, sometimes work that I didn't want to do,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure I could have kept way more people busy. But yeah. It's just at some point you have to ask why. Like, what's the value in that?
Yeah.
I bet the contractors would have been, well, the value would have been in like health insurance or something, yeah, or more money or something. But
right.
It didn't make sense for me, really.
Yeah, but that's kind of that's the kind of story, I guess, that I want to ultimately kind of tell with this is
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us start off as designers and we have this vague idea of what it is that we want to do and we don't know how to do it. And so when we can hear how someone else has gone and done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then we can say, oh, that's a way I could do it. You know, that's something to try. It's a different model than what I've seen at the design firms in the town where I mm-hmm. live or where I went to college, you know. So it's helpful, I think, for people to hear that those reasons behind doing things that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because I have a lot of friends who, you know, are getting to that point in their career where they're looking for what's next.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them say, hey, you want to go out and grab a drink? I want to pick your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
And almost always it's like, hey, I've been thinking of leaving the studio I'm at. I want to go out on my own and launch my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done so great. You know, I want to talk to you about it. And I'm like, what makes you think I'm doing great? Like there's a perception and there's a reality.
Yes, yeah.
And the perception is, oh, you're doing great work. All this stuff's going on. I'm like, you know, if you want to design, stay designing. If you want to deal with trying to run a business, that's a completely different set of responsibilities.
Yeah.
And so they'd ask about what it's like, and it makes it seem like all glorious. But the truth is that you're running a business, and you have to, like, the printer goes down, and who has to fix the printer?
Mm-hmm.
I do. You know, the internet stops working. Great. Who's going to deal with that? Now, smart people, of course, would hire people to deal with that.
Yeah.
But I'm also very cheap, so I, you know, try to take care of it myself. So it's just I think it's a career path that a lot of designers feel like they have to take, like that's the next logical step. And for a lot of them, you know, I think they need to find out for themselves. It's
mm-hmm.
I can't sit there and say you're going to hate it or you're going to love it, because I think everyone's different.
Yeah.
So I try to be encouraging, but also say, like, like, what are you really searching for that's leading you to believe that you would rather run a business than do like full-time design work?
It seems like a lot of people think that that's what they have to do to get to do the work they really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that that helped you? Like, were you able to do more of the work you were passionate about or that you really wanted to pursue by having your own studio?
I would say that that's true, but I did it at the expense of the other projects, meaning one of the reasons why I didn't take on a bunch of employees was because I only wanted to take on a certain amount of work to make a certain amount of money so I could afford to do the projects that I wanted to do.
Yeah, think that through.
Yeah, and that's a decision I made. Like, I made pretty good money, but then I spent it all.
Yeah.
And I spent it doing the things that I wanted to do. And that's the choice I made, you know? And that worked out for me. I mean, I would rather do the stuff that I'm interested in, at least part-time than, you know, lose that entirely.
Yeah. So it sounds like you had so much different experience going into starting that studio. Mm-hmm. Did the previous experience you had, kind of breed some clients that you could take on with you, or did you have to start from scratch finding clients?
I don't know that it wasn't. Well, yeah, I guess I did pretty much start from scratch. I mean, every client that I think I've ever had, or every company that I've ever worked with, is from a relationship of some sort.
Okay.
Meaning, getting the call from Apple was because of someone I went to college with.
Okay.
And, you know, getting the calls from various companies were because of other relationships I'd had.
Okay.
Very rarely did I get like a cold call that actually ended up in an actual project.
Yeah.
But it did happen like once or twice. But always there's a referral behind there somewhere. So it wasn't like I had a stable of clients built up. It was more like I had met enough people that when they knew I was available, or I could say, hey, I'm launching my own thing now, let me know if you know anyone who needs help.
Okay.
Those things start to pop up here and there.
Okay. So did you find it difficult to have that, to take that from that more personal relationship into the business relationship?
Not really. I mean, it wasn't like it shifted to a business relationship. It was more like, hey, this is what I'm doing now, and if you need some help, let me know, or if you know people. And I found that if people trust you and know that you're like a good person to work with or have talent, then they're happy to recommend you.
Sure.
Problem is I hang out with a lot of designers, so of course, like, everybody's talented, and like, I find myself like recommending, you know, clients to designers because now I can't do the work, but also sometimes it's just a better fit. Like,
sure.
I could not possibly take on the size of the project you're asking for. These are the people that I admire. Go talk to them.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately that's the, I've done that, and I've seen other people do it, and I think ultimately that's a better business thing to do, because if you try to take it on when you know you shouldn't, nobody's going to be happy.
Yeah, you fail and you burn that relationship, as opposed to getting them the right fit and not making any money off it, which is totally fine.
Sure. Yeah. So did you, because you had those previous relationships, it sounds like you probably didn't have to do a lot to promote yourself. It was just kind of calling people you had discussed projects with before and kind of following through on previous conversations.
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't say it was that easy at all. I would say that I am a relentless self-promoter.
Okay.
I tend to do it not directly,
okay. But
I do it by promoting the stuff that I like,
okay. With
the hopes or the expectation that, like, if people gravitate towards that, then those are the type of people I'd like to work with.
Okay.
At one point on my website, I had a very sort of polarizing political project.
Okay.
And I had friends saying, like, I can't believe you put that up on your site. Don't you realize you're, like, going to alienate 50% of your possible clients? And I said, absolutely. Like, those are the 50% that I don't want to work with.
Sure.
And then it's sort of self-fulfilling. You know, if people see that and don't want to work with the person who created that project, then we don't need to go through the painful process of trying to work together.
Of getting halfway through a project and figuring out this doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, good. So it worked.
It sort of worked. But, like, behind the scenes, there is a lot of work that goes into making sure that people remember that you're out there.
Yeah.
So still to this day, I'm even though I don't have a business to promote, I'm still doing projects that I think, like, I send stuff out. I always liked receiving things in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked hanging things in my cubicle. There's nothing more rewarding than walking through the offices of the SF MoMA and seeing people's cubicles that had some of the stuff I had sent them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that, you know, that's awesome. That's the best marketing you can do.
Right.
Because they kept it and they hung it.
And they see that and they think of you, hopefully.
Yeah. And someone else says, hey, that's cool. Who did that? And it's like, oh, this guy over here did that.
Yeah. So. That's cool. So, like you said, you've moved on. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But do you feel like as you've moved on that Altitude is over? Or is it on hold? Or is it a smaller percentage of what you do now?
Well, no, I don't take on any client work now. Mm-hmm. When I still get inquiries, because the website's still up,
uh-huh.
and when I get those inquiries, I recommend other firms that could help out. And I still get a lot of applications for interns and designers, even though it says pretty clearly on the contact area that we're not hiring.
Right.
I'm not sure. I sort of say that I put it on hiatus for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure what the future holds. So I'm not really sure that even if I were to ever leave my current employment situation, would I go back or would I go forward? You know, it's like, is there something more interesting out there that I could pursue that would be more interesting than just running a design firm?
Right.
I mean, there was a reason I made a shift, and it was because I was looking for something slightly different or I wanted to learn more.
Yeah.
You could always go back, but I'd rather keep going forward.
Yeah, and maybe this is the best time to kind of get it. So what kind of did make you what spurred you to think, I've got my own firm, and it, like you said, maybe it wasn't doing, you weren't making millions, but you were doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of designers, it seems like that's kind of a dream situation, and then you from an outsider point of view, it might look like you decided to kind of give up some freedom and go work for a bigger company. So kind of what led you to that?
Well, I think anyone who knows me closely enough to have drinks and hear me rant about stuff, had probably spent the last couple of years hearing me sort of not disillusioned, but very sort of questioning what we're doing.
Okay.
and what it means to be a designer and where we're having the most impact. And I think it was just my external sort of the way I was processing sort of frustration of not having the impact with the companies I was working with. And this could be because of the size of Altitude. It could be because we weren't one of these giant companies that's engaged to, you know, really embed themselves within their, you know, like I think of the multi-million dollar contracts that certain companies get to,
like you had a research to solve, 100 interns and
exactly to solve real business problems. And even some of the startups we were helping doing really, really interesting work, like trying to help a company visualize water use and help monitor leaks and things like that through user experience, digital, you know, tools. But in the end, like, you have to turn that over to the company and decisions are made. And then you see what they build and you're like, well, why did you put that in? It's like, oh, because we wanted this particular feature. It's like, but we went through what the specific things, like the use cases, you know, the most. So what I'm getting at is that I just realized that to have the impact and the influence over those things, you actually kind of needed to be in-house.
Mm.
And so that got me thinking about where, if I were to go in-house, what that would mean. And of all the companies out there that you could possibly have a huge impact, at a fast-moving company that's involved in technology and shaping the way that humans interact, Facebook seemed like a very logical place to go.
Did that opportunity come about the same way your other opportunities did? Was there a previous acquaintance, or did you have to kind of court them or apply for a position?
Well, what's funny is I actually, because I was doing this, I didn't reach out to friends and say, hey, I'm looking for something new. I just started looking around and seeing what was out there. And so when you do that, you sometimes find a job posting that looks appropriate and you apply for it through the website. And that's what I did. And then I realized, like, those things probably end up in a database somewhere and never get looked at.
Yeah.
So I then wrote messages to, I don't know, the five or so people I knew that worked at Facebook and said, hey, this is the job that I applied for. Is this something that, you know, the hiring manager for could, like, make sure my resume lands on the right desk?
Sure.
And I don't remember hearing back from any of them except Ben Berry, who said, I just forwarded your stuff on to our recruiter and told her that, like, go talk to this guy.
Okay.
So that was really how it happened. I don't think I would have even been invited through the door if Ben hadn't told his recruiter. And his recruiter was in a different group. So I had a phone conversation with her. She's like, oh, you're applying for that position. That's a different recruiter. Uh-huh. Had a conversation with her. And that's how the process started.
Yeah. Interesting. Because I know that you can't necessarily talk about a lot of specifics about what you do there. Are you enjoying it? I'm assuming you are.
Well, it's funny because when I first got there, it's a whirlwind, and it's trying to understand the culture, which is different than I think any other major corporation, trying to keep up with all the moving parts. And there's just a lot of moving pieces. It was really difficult. It was really challenging. And, I ran into a friend and they're like, yeah, I heard you hate it there. I'm like, what do you mean? I hate it there. It's like, oh, I heard you were unhappy. I'm like, no, it's hard. It's the hardest job I've ever had in my life.
Okay.
But that's why I keep going back.
So it's hard in a challenging way?
It is. I go there and I have, like, there are days when I have no idea how to do what I'm supposed to do.
Okay.
And to me, that's an interesting problem to try to solve. It's challenging myself in ways that I don't think I've ever been challenged before.
So then I guess for that to be something that you are kind of happy about, it sounds like you're happy about that, they must support that. They must make you feel like, yeah, come in, and if you have something to do that you don't know how to do, good. Figure out how to do it. It sounds like that there's that kind of nurturing.
Well, it's definitely a nurturing. I mean, I've had two managers while I've been there, and they've both been super supportive. What do you need? What can I help you with? Here's some advice how to navigate through things. But it's really, you know, having a vision of where I want the team to go.
Okay.
And trying to figure out how to get it there.
Okay.
And that's the difficult part because there's a lot of moving pieces. It's more complex than any client work that I've ever done.
Hmm.
And it's people managing, it's relationship managing, and it's also building up trust. If people don't trust you, they're not going to listen to you, and you have to go around and prove that you can do what you say you can do.
Yeah.
So I do enjoy it. It is challenging, and I have good days and bad days, I think, like everyone else. Sure. But I also think someone asked me, like, if there's one attribute that you have that you think leads you to success, what is it? And I think I answered the question poorly, and what my answer should have been was that I seek out and put myself in uncomfortable situations.
Okay.
The moment I start getting comfortable, I put myself in a situation where I'm stretching myself too thin, I'm biting off more than I can chew, or I'm trying to solve something that I have no idea how to solve. Yeah. And I think that's sort of propelled me in learning sort of throughout my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why Facebook's great for me, is because it's pushing me to learn things that are not the easiest things. I mean, I can design anything,
yeah.
But I'm not designing at Facebook.
Right. It sounds like, or you're designing in a different way.
Correct.
You're designing solutions to bigger problems than visual problems, probably.
Correct. Well, and it's also the role is more of people management.
Mm-hmm.
And less of creative direction. I mean, my team's great. They don't need anyone telling them how to make anything better.
Yeah.
But what I try to provide is the ties to the right departments, making sure that everything's lined up in the right way,
mm-hmm.
Making sure we've got the right people looking at it at the right time, things like that.
Cool. It's fascinating. I was actually earlier today having this discussion with my brother about that innovation model that businesses mm-hmm. are. Facebook, you know, is one of the examples of, you know, that people often look to them as a business and a group that does that. But it seems it's running all throughout business and design everywhere, and it's where business and design are coming together. And it sounds like that's what you're doing there. It's that kind of get in there, fail early, learn from how you failed, and move on, and be uncomfortable. That's better than if you're comfortable, you're doing something wrong.
There was a joke. I forget who was telling me this, but said if you're working on a project and no one else is trying to interfere,
mm-hmm.
Then it's probably not an important project.
Uh-huh.
And so that talks about like the scale, like the bigger the impact of the project you're working on, the more voices, the more opinions, the more people you need to sort of seek approval from.
Yeah.
And that's a really good sign of how much impact you're having. If you're if you're designing in a corner and no one cares, then the impact might not be so huge.
Yeah.
Cool.
So do you feel like are you using a design process that you had established before in a different way in this job?
I think that process, like the design process, you could look at the design process on 100 different design firms' websites, mm-hmm. and 90 out of 100 will have a very similar five-step process, and they'll call it the 5 D's or the 5 T's or the whatever they call it. But it's a very similar process. Mm-hmm. I think that you can try to bring that logic to like an internal design department, mm-hmm. But Facebook works much differently than I think a lot of. I mean, not having worked at a lot of like larger companies, sure. but my instinct tells me that this is not a normal company. Small teams, very flat organization. Everybody moves very fast, and I think that maybe my traditional idea of process is evolving to be successful in that environment.
Okay.
Because it's an environment that you have to work within. So it's not about me trying to force like here's the design process we follow. It's more about like, okay, here's how this company works, and here's how we can be most effective in this environment.
But maybe the process is less of a it's less of a structure and more of just a system of evolving or a
everything is
going to be the best word.
Well, it's just understanding like there are so many moving pieces on any given project that being able to understand those and look ahead and sort of predict where like. Where you need to get buy-in and when, mm-hmm. and make sure that, oh, last time we had this problem at the end with translation, so let's give translation enough time this time. Uh-huh. So, like you said, you go through these projects, you learn from the mistakes, and you make sure that you fix it the next time.
Yeah.
And if you do this enough times very fast, you actually get to a really good process quicker.
Yeah, cool. But just a lot of iteration.
Yeah, pretty much.
Cool. One of the goals for this show is to reach designers who are struggling and trying to figure out how to get somewhere with what they want to do, maybe trying to define what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I try to ask everyone about is just kind of some of the lessons that you've learned or some advice that you might have for people who are starting out or finishing school or looking for that kind of career change or something like that. So I'm curious. Maybe what do you think is the most important lesson you've learned as a designer?
The most important. I feel like there's lots of lessons.
Maybe a few then.
Well, I do think there's a lot of truth to and it sounds really corny, but doing what you love. Mm-hmm. And Vanessa Eckstein was speaking from Block, and someone in the audience asked her a question, and they're like, how do you get to do such amazing work? Uh-huh. We have to do like a bunch of crap projects at my office. And she said, well, the moment you do a crap project, you're going to keep doing crap projects. Mm-hmm. So stop doing them. It was essentially what she was saying. And it's like, if you do a good project, like people hire you based on your past, not the future.
Right.
So if you show them a bunch of crap work and they hire you, that's what their expectation is going to be. So do what you love, pursue that, and everything else should sort of fall into place. There's also I feel like designers, I just did this piece that says designer see, designer do. Uh-huh. And it's really a reaction to the fact that I think we as a profession tend to follow in the footsteps of those that we admire, mm-hmm. meaning we look up to people that we consider being successes in the industry, and then we sort of mimic our careers along those paths. And I don't know that that's the best way for our profession to evolve. Mm-hmm. I feel like the people that are veering from that path are probably going to be the most successful. Mm-hmm. And so it's this idea of just, blaze your own path, like stop following, start leading.
Yeah.
And the more people pursue those weird, quirky ideas that they have, the better chance they have of breaking out of like the typical, what I would say is like the design career path of like building your career, winning some awards, and submitting stuff to books, maybe teaching at some point. All sort of follow this very similar path.
Right.
And I'm guilty of it as a lot of people are. And it's just weird when you start questioning like, why did I think that was important?
Mm-hmm. Like you were saying earlier, the people that are coming to you and saying, they feel like they're at that point in their career where they need to start their own studio or their own firm or something like that. It's one of those steps that seems like that you get out of school and you try to win some awards and you go work for a bigger company until you get to the point where you can start your own thing. and then you mm-hmm. try to win accolades for that, and then you teach.
Yeah. Well, but I think you bring up, it just started crystallizing in my mind, is that like there are a lot of designers that are at that point in their career, and they don't know what's next. Mm-hmm. And they're searching for what's next, and they're not quite sure what it's going to be. Oh. And I guess like maybe it doesn't need to be anything. It doesn't need to be starting your own design firm. It doesn't need to be going in-house. It doesn't need to be like, it could be something completely different.
It doesn't need to be anything familiar in the sense of I've seen someone do this before.
No, it should be, what I'm interested in is gardening or cooking or NASCAR. I don't know. And I'm going to apply my skills and interests to that and let that sort of take me on a path.
Yeah.
That might be more interesting than starting a design firm.
Right. Yeah. Cool. So in that same sense of kind of what you've learned, what do you think the hardest thing about being a designer is?
I think that designers always feel underappreciated, that nobody understands us. Mm-hmm. We are in a profession that claims to be able to help companies or causes communicate clearly, mm-hmm. yet we seem to have a hard time doing it ourselves. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I like that. That's something that's always struck me as, you know, designers designing their own identity takes three times as long because
they, the hardest job you'll ever have.
Yeah. Yeah. So we struggle with this. We struggle with this, like wanting to be invited to the, we want to be appreciated. We want a seat at the table, the decision-making table. And I used this example in my talk at the Y conference, but, you know, when the Gap logo stuff happened, everyone remembers the wonderful Gap fiasco. And I asked the audience, I said, how many people thought this, you know, the new logo sucked? And some people raised their hands. And I asked, well, how many of you read the strategic brief for that? Mm. How many of you understood the business strategy behind the shift? Mm-hmm. And how many of you knew who their target market was with this? I mean, for all we know, Gap's being cannibalized by Old Navy and Banana Republic and is searching for something new. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're marketing towards 13-year-old girls. Like, that's not me. Yeah. So, like, I can understand why I might not react positively to the logo. Mm-hmm. But we like what happened was the design community, you know, started revolting about what a crappy logo it was.
Yeah.
And it was like out of context. So we've been fighting for the seat at the table saying that what we do is not objective or not subjective, but it's strategic and it's solving business goals. And then the Gap logo comes out and we immediately say, we don't like it. It sucks.
Yeah.
Based on no knowledge of what the objective was. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole industry, you know, shot ourselves in the foot with that. And it was like really disappointing to me that was, you know, we fight for the seat at the table and then, you know, we start to get that seat at the table and a bunch of whiny designers, you know, hate this logo. I mean, I don't personally think it was a great logo, but I really don't care. Like I don't necessarily shop at the Gap. It's, I don't think I'm the target market.
Sure.
And if I want to evaluate it, I'd really like to evaluate it knowing what they were trying to achieve rather than, whether I like it.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe the lesson there for a younger designer is that you've got to take in the bigger picture. Maybe sometimes you've got to dig in for some of those details and
ask more questions instead of, you know, providing more critical advice out of context.
Yeah, it's funny because in a sense, I feel like the design industry is begging for some criticism to kind of help, but. There's a healthy criticism and a healthy discussion to have, and then there's the like you're saying that kind of discussion that just breaks down what we've been trying to build.
Exactly, but I mean it's a symptom of the internet. You know, there are more voices now that can be heard. You know, read the comments on any article that's posted, and it's amazing that, you know, this is really what we have to offer.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily talking design. I'm talking like read, you know, on the news, any article that's posted and they have the little comments area. And I like reading through those just to see like who are these people that are writing these things that some of which are completely out of place or obnoxious and rude and serve no purpose really.
And why do they feel like they need to do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I think kind of leads into what kind of advice would you have for a designer that's trying to start out?
Trying to get a job or just trying to like start in their career?
That general sense of starting out and trying to figure out what the best place for you is. And so, yeah, you know, that when you're trying to find a job or you're trying to decide if working in-house is the right thing for you, or getting a design firm job, or trying to do freelance, or any of those things. Mm-hmm. Is there kind of one piece of advice that you think young designers need to hear?
Well, I think that and this is strange because I think my career path has taken a different turn than a lot of other people's, but I needed and appreciated the ability to try out a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. Meaning I've worked by myself. I've worked at a 3-person firm. I've worked at a 10-person firm. I've worked for a 100-person design department. And it's those experiences that really helped me hone in on what it is that I want to do. Mm-hmm. Or where I'm both most successful and most happy. And I think it's really hard to guess that as a young designer. I didn't, and maybe this is just my path of like not knowing. So I had to go try all the flavors to pick which flavor was my favorite. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage them not to get too set down any, like too locked into any path. Mm-hmm. Because there might be something else out there that they just haven't experienced yet.
Let the road take you where it takes you.
Yeah. Or try new things. Like the moment you, if you've been at a firm and you're not learning anymore, it's probably time to move on. Mm-hmm. And learn something new.
Sure. I think that's maybe the right piece of advice to wrap up on.
Excellent.
So thank you very much for sitting down and talking with me and taking time out of the crazy Creative Summit schedule this weekend to sit down and talk.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Yeah,
thank you very much.
And that's Make Ready episode number 5. Thank you once more to Brian Singer for stepping away from Creative Summit to record the conversation with me. I hope everyone out there enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with Brian. Please join me next time, and remember, you get what you make. Or as Brian put it, you get what you put out there. This is Duncan Robertson with Make Ready Podcast.